You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, Christ is risen. This is the Orthodox Nationalist. Of course, I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded Easter night, 2026, the 12th of April. And I thought it fitting to deal with the concept of Pascha and Easter, and what it means on numerous levels. You know, in the Jewish media, they always make sure to try to run insulting articles and things like that. But I want to do somewhat of an apologia for it, using many sources, as I always do. There's a lot of misconceptions, including just on the icon itself, but Christianity, or Orthodoxy, 2,000 years old, plus. But believe it or not, today you have a more, the concept of a resurrection, a bodily resurrection, is more prevalent than it was at the time of Christ's resurrection. In fact, as many have pointed out, Christianity was born into a world where its central tenet, that of the resurrection of Jesus, had no ontological category. No one had conceived of it before. Most believed that the dead were simply winked out of existence. There may have been some Judaic sects that believed in some variation of the afterlife. Those who actually took the Old Testament seriously. But outside of them, no one believed in the resurrection. That is to say, a bodily resurrection. It was a major area of criticism. And hence, the apologetics of the very big first Christians would deal with this fairly traumatic issue. We'll talk about the theories that attempt to debunk this. They'll come up with anything. They'll say anything. They'll do anything. The Bart Ehrmans of the world, these people, to delegitimize Orthodoxy, Christianity, whatever. But as I've said before, any apologetics has to start off by pointing out that Christianity, or Christ personally, did everything that you shouldn't do if you wanted to start a popular religious movement. In other words, had he not been resurrected and people witnessed his body afterwards, whatever small group he had would have failed immediately. Keep in mind something. Becoming a Christian back then, and often today, meant severance of family ties. But a severance of family ties to follow a man who had been crucified. The most dishonorable and degrading form of punishment. Only for the worst class of criminals. It wasn't banned until the Emperor Constantine. Christ defied all the expectations of both the remnant of the Israelites and Romans of his day. It demanded a strict code of conduct, then and now, with the only reward being persecution. Hence, the only thing they had going for them was the resurrection of this criminal, according to the law at the time, in bodily form. something ontologically inconceivable in the categories of the day. This is one of the reasons we know, one of the many reasons we know the Gospels are true. There have been many who have expounded on the concept of just how, Christ, it almost was like he was trying to piss everybody off in the ancient world, as if to say that everyone is wrong. Of course, I'm God, and I'm going to start a church, and it's not going to be what you think it's going to be, because the only thing you care about is money and power. The Jews fell away into what eventually will be codified in the Talmud and et cetera. And paganism will disappear, but it will reemerge some kind of celebrity worship later on. Now, obviously, the church fathers spoke at length, but this one central tenet, the resurrection of Christ from the tomb, St. Ignatius of Antioch, very, very early church father, very late first century, talks about the bodily resurrection. There was some concept of, almost zombieism that existed, but not a bodily resurrection, and certainly not in any kind of glorified form. And in fact, St. Ignatius really hits on the bodily nature of Christ's resurrection by recalling that information in the Gospels. The Gospel is already taken as authoritative in the first century. And he was contrasting it with demons who, of course, didn't have a body. Let me quote him here. This is from his epistle to the Smyrnans, chapters 2 and 3. "For he suffered all of these things for our sake, so we might be saved. And he suffered truly, as he also raised himself truly. Not as certain unbelievers say that he suffered in semblance, being themselves mere semblance. And according to their opinions, so shall it happen to them, for they are without body and demon-like. For I know and believe that he was in the flesh even after the resurrection. When he came to Peter and company, he said to them, 'Lay hold and handle me, and see that I am not a ghost, a demon without body.' And they touched him, and they believed, being joined unto his flesh and blood. Wherefore also they despised death, nay, they were found superior to death." Ignatius was up against a culture that rejected the concept of a bodily resurrection. And of all people, some nobody. Now, I would recommend you find my work on, Galilee Christ being a Greek, Greek ethnically necessarily, but being raised in a Greek culture, despite going to the temple for his education. But at the time, the afterlife, it might be accepted. It was accepted in the abstract, kind of like today. This is what St. Ambrose says. "Now, since you're celebrating the Holy Pascha, you should know, brethren, what the Pascha is. Pascha means the crossing over. And so the feast is called by this name. For it was on this day that the children of Israel crossed over out of Egypt, and the Son of God crossed over from this world to the world of his Father. What gains it to celebrate unless you imitate him whom you worship? That is, unless you cross over from Egypt, that is, from the darkness of evil doing, to the light of virtue, from the love of this world, to the love of your heavenly home." Now, the reason this is important is because it's building up to the concept of the two judgments. One in spirit, that is to say, just our disembodied essence, and the other at the end of time, body and soul. Now, Jesus maintained his full ontological makeup at all times. Now, don't ask me about the mechanics of this, but in body and soul, he went to Hades. We'll get into that here in a minute. St. Augustine says, "God, the wonderful and inexpressible artisan, will with inexpressible speed restore our flesh from the whole of the material of which it was constituted. It will make no difference to its reconstruction, whether hairs go back to hairs or nails go back to nails, or whatever of these had perished, be changed to flesh and be assigned to other parts of the body. The providence of the artisan will take care that nothing unseemly result. And he's talking about, you know, the end of days when the body is reconstituted from God knows what. But he's building to the idea of there is a judgment after death, of course. But the final is the one at the end of days. On Holy Saturday, Christ is sent into hell. Now, this is a big issue. Hell is not Gehenna. We have a few ways to approach this here. Coming from a Catholic background, when I converted back in the 90s, this was a big problem for me. I didn't know what it meant for Christ to descend into hell. What he was doing there in the first place. The other term for it is Hades or Sheol, the spirits in prison, as St. Peter calls them. Now, the concept can be found in both Testaments, but it is a we'll get to this in just a second, but for now, hell can be understood as a holding place where the souls of both the good and the evil went after death, everybody. It is not Gehenna, the place of eternal torment. St. Gregory the Theologian says the following. On this great day, Christ is called from among the dead, which he had emulated. On this day, he repelled death's sting, laid low the gloomy confines of Hades, and granted freedom to its souls. On this day, risen from the tomb, he appeared to people for whom he had been born, had died, been awakened from the dead, so that we, having been reborn and escaped death, might be resurrected with him, the resurrected one. On this bright, glorious, and great day, the angelic hosts, filled with joy, sing a song of victory. Now, when I first converted, I also had a bit of a struggle with what Jesus did between the cross and the ascension. Now, we know he appeared to the apostles. I'm not talking about that. Both in 1 Peter 3:18, 25, and the second chapter of Acts, the baptism of the dead in 1 Corinthians, or even 1 Peter 4. Jesus preached to the dead. Everyone who had been, you know, everyone had a soul, apparently. And Christ went and, body and soul, preached to them. Now, St. John Damascene says that free will hadn't been taken from them, that not all were liberated, not all accepted him, not all believed what he was saying. Even St. Jerome said that. But it wasn't an absolute destination. What it comes down to is, roughly in the 17th century, it was a translation error in the King James Version of the Bible that confused Hades with hell. Hades, Sheol, was translated into hell. And the same mistake is made today all the time. You know, the rich man and Lazarus, that situation, it was torment, but it was Hades, it was Sheol, or at least a nasty part of it, in Luke. But most of the translations of the Bible that I've come across, and I've actually spent some time on this, simply say that the rich man went to hell in a place of fire. That simply isn't the case. St. Irenaeus wrote in Against Heresies, "For as the Lord went away in the midst of the shadow of death, where the souls of the dead were, yet afterward arose in the body, and after the resurrection was taken up into heaven, it is manifest that the souls of his disciples also, upon whose account the Lord underwent these things, shall go away into the invisible place allotted to them by God, and there remain until the resurrection, awaiting that event, then receiving their bodies, and rising in their entirety, that is, bodily, just as the Lord arose, they shall come thus into the presence of God." And of course, he's referring here to the final judgment. St. Tikhon of Zadonsk, much later, in Russia says this: Christ was risen, and so we too have to be resurrected with Christ in order to ascend with him. A resurrection is twofold, body and spirit. Our bodily resurrection will take place at the end. We speak of this when we recite the creed and the symbols of faith. I look for the resurrection of the dead. To be resurrected spiritually is to depart from our sins, turn away from the vanities of the world, abide in true repentance and faith, and take up the struggle against sin, to do the will of our Heavenly Father, to live his truth, and to follow Christ, Son of God, with humility, love, meekness, and patience. There's a new creation of which the Holy Apostle speaks when he says, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Now, because of the Catholic doctrine of purgatory, the idea of Hades or Sheol has been pushed to the side, even though they still talk about limbo from time to time. But all of this was quite confusing. When Christ went to death, death was a place and went to it, and it tried to swallow it. It couldn't, as all the liturgical texts say, and metaphorically burst the gates. This is why the resurrection icons really don't seem to have much to do about resurrection. The resurrection icons of the Orthodox Church are Christ descending into Hades or Sheol and rescuing Adam and Eve, among others, depending on how complex the icon is, from his clutches. To say that both the good and the bad and everyone in between was there meant that there was a certain level of punishment for the bad and reward for the good, but it wasn't final. But that's what he did, and that's what happened prior to that's what happened on Saturday. Then he appeared to the apostles, etc., etc. And eventually, preaching for a certain amount of time, he then ascended them to heaven. Every once in a while, I get asked about the connection with pagan stories, whatever paganism might be. I've come across this many times over the years, the Earl Dohertys and the Herbert Kuttners and Alvar Ellingard and all these people that claim that the resurrection story, among other things, comes from pagan myth. That the Christians were so bereft of imagination that they had to go elsewhere to get their ideas and simply computed down as if no one's going to notice. Well, other than that, these are only issues for those who have never read the surviving fragments or the scholarly literature. You know, Johnson's Law even applies here. I mean, who's going to go and read these fragments? For example, sometimes Osiris gets brought up. And these people that I mentioned, many others, create assertions that he was just like Christ. And in fact, he wasn't. I've read the fragments. The translations are always very tentative. But he wasn't a dying god at all. He was a god of the dead. Osiris was murdered, his body dismembered and scattered. The pieces of his body were recovered and rejoined, and he was rejuvenated. But he didn't return to his normal mode of existence. He remained in the underworld, where he became the powerful lord of the dead. And usually he's depicted as a mummy, the dead monarch. And that comes from the book Kingship and the Gods, the study of ancient Near Eastern religion as the integration of society and nature. None of that has anything to do with the New Testament. Another one that comes up is Mithra. And nowhere in the Mithraic studies literature was this man ever buried. Or even dying, for that matter. There was no rising again. There was no resurrection. They claim that he was raised at Easter, actually in late March. But the feasts that were celebrated in his honor were October 8th and another in September and one in October. Dionysius also. Dionysius is a less common connection. They don't talk about Dionysius very much. But he's said to have risen from the dead on March 25th. And there is zero evidence to support this. Whatever the rising from the dead might mean to these people, and they play very fast and loose with language. There's a single inscription in the city of Tathos that describes this deity as a god who renews himself and returns every year rejuvenated. And that, therefore, is supposed to tell us that he has resurrected and Jesus was patterned on him. It's no different than the cycle of nature, which all of these entities were symbolizing. The Sumerian Tammuz, which gets mentioned once in a while, was murdered by raiders from the netherworld who attacked him and stole his sheep. He was mourned by his family, but he didn't stay dead. He came back again later, rescued by his consort and some demons who sang to him. No one talks about how this happened. And it certainly has no relation to resurrection in our definition of the term. It's simply, the scholarly literature anyway, on Tammuz recognizes this story as just representative as a usual birth-death cycle of vegetation. Another one is Adonis. But the only account of his death comes from a text dated the 2nd century AD, a little late. Apparently, it's described how his death at the hands of a boar was mourned by worshippers in Byblos. And then the next day, they proclaim that he lives and send him into the air, whatever that means. In fact, I don't know what that means. Most of the rituals connected to Adonis connect him to vegetation. They accentuate his death, have nothing to do with his rebirth. Remember, as I wrote in my paper on paganism, it's not a religion. I like to think of the pagan myths as a constitution of ancient society. It was okay that these stories were always changing. It didn't matter if people had different interpretations. There was no such thing as heresy. There was no catechism of the ancient pagan world. But the classical accounts of Adonis, they don't mention or describe rising from the dead. And those fashioned by Christian writers later introduces a theme of Adonis' resurrection. A little bit of a problem there. Zoroaster, another one. Yes, he was murdered. But that doesn't seem to have much significance. There's a few stories about his death. He's actually mentioned in, Tammuz is mentioned in the great Gilgamesh epic. We're talking about now the same part of the world. There was a much later story has him struck by lightning. That's a post-Christian source. He was killed at 77 by a wizard. And it doesn't go beyond that. None of these are connected in any way to the Christian notion. I think I know my way around the ancient myths. I mean, you can only go so far. The translations are always iffy. But I've actually read some of them. If you read the text that they claim say these things, you realize that they don't. They're not written in code. They're available for everybody. The fragments over the millennia are fluid. They're open to interpretation. Not to mention they're using languages that are long dead. And I've said this 100 times before, but the parallel meaning of terms, something these guys rely on, cross-cultural assumptions. Use the word resurrection or baptism. That means the exact same thing that what we're talking about. But the mere addition of the word doesn't make it true. I think most of this stuff has been refuted. But it's interesting at least to get people to start reading the ancient text. I don't know if you know this, but Peter Kreeft is still alive. I read him in grad school quite a bit. He's 90 years old. He, along with others like C.S. Lewis, Edwin Iannucci, spoke of the resurrection and come to the conclusion that it can be proven with at least as much certainty as any well-documented event in ancient history. You got to remember, as far as the modernists are concerned, the standards to support a Christian idea are 10 times what it would be for, say, a Platonic one. Let me quote Peter Kreeft here just to be clear. To prove this, we don't need to presuppose anything controversial, but the skeptic must also not presuppose anything. You do not need to presuppose that the New Testament is infallible or divinely inspired or even true. You do not need to presuppose that there really was an empty tomb or a post-resurrection appearance. We presuppose only 2 things, both of which are hard data, empirical data, no one denies. The existence of the New Testament texts as we have them, and the existence of the Christian religion as we find it today. Using just that data, what do we have? Generally speaking, and C.S. Lewis, I'm sure this was done prior to C.S. Lewis, but he made it famous. 5 possible theories as to what happened. Either he really did rise from the dead, whether the women, the apostles, were under a long-standing hallucination of some type. Whether, in fact, the apostles created the deception, that they were myth-makers themselves, that they were deceivers, or he simply didn't die that day, and he survived. I can't imagine surviving that and functioning whatsoever, especially with guards at the tomb. So either the apostles, according to some of these theories, they were either deceived, you know, they thought he did, or they were deceivers. They knew he didn't and created a story. Now, all of these theories are logically possible. Therefore, we have to be fair with them. Even the Christian one, believe it or not. Now, there's more absurd things like Christ never existed. The whole story was the world's greatest fantasy novel written by someone. He was a literary character whom everyone in history mistook for a real person, including all Christians and their enemies. Until some scholar, many centuries later, discovered the truth from sources that they don't name, some enlightened one. So generally speaking, it's a childish point of view. And I spend most of my time ignoring it. It's been refuted many times. J.B. Perez, many years ago, wrote a humorous paper that Napoleon didn't exist and actually gave very similar arguments. that those who claim this for Christ use. But its main promoter, G.A. Wells, has abandoned the concept, so I'm not sure what's left of that. But enough of that. But if these theories that it didn't happen can be refuted, then the resurrection happened. I mean, neither God nor the resurrection are directly observable. But from data that are observable, we can argue only that the possible adequate explanation of this data is the Christian one. Jesus did not survive crucifixion, and I was surprised how popular this theory was. It implies that the Romans had no idea what medicine was or what the human body was. Roman procedures in this regard were extremely careful. And the soldiers on that detail were well aware of them. There were strict punishments if someone were to escape because they weren't dead, especially in a capital case. It's pretty easy to perceive that someone is dead through pulse, through many things. The Roman soldier didn't break Jesus' legs, but he did to the other two in the Gospel of John. That means the soldier was sure that Jesus was dead. You know, breaking of the legs hastened death of the corpse. You know, it got nastier at that point. It wasn't just a matter of exposure. And crucifixion was such a nasty, nasty way to go. You break their legs, they couldn't support themselves anymore. So it was a variation of hanging. St. John, who was an eyewitness, said he saw blood and water come from Jesus' pierced heart. Well, there's medical science behind that. It means his lungs had collapsed at this point, and he died of asphyxiation. His body was totally encased in winding sheets and entombed. I'm using John for all of it. Now, it would be impossible for the apostles to be as transformed as individuals as they were if he just somehow struggled out of the tomb. Half dead, staggering, a very sick man. This person would not be worshipped as the conqueror of death. And how were the Roman guards at the tomb overpowered by this barely functional man? Or by unarmed disciples? Not to mention moving the massive stone at the door. It took many people to move a stone. Neither the Jews nor the Romans would move it, for it was in their interest to keep the tomb sealed. Jews had the stone put there in the first place. And of course, they were the prime movers of all of this. Let's be very clear. That is the Jews who wanted Christ dead. Pontius Pilate did not. He had done nothing wrong. He tried to reason with these lunatics. And so much of the Jewish mind comes from this moment, where they absolutely refused. And in fact, they said that they'll lie. They'll go to the emperor and say that this man is no friend of Caesar. This was Palestine was kind of a frontier area. It was always very restless. The survival theory is frankly a stupid one. Then the deception idea. The apostles were deceivers. In the Pensées, Blaise Pascal says this: the apostles were either deceived or deceivers. Either supposition is difficult, for it is not possible to imagine that a man who has risen from the dead, while Jesus was with them, he could sustain them, but afterwards, if he did not appear to them, Who did make them act? The hypothesis that the apostles were knaves is quite absurd. Follow it to the end. Imagine these 12 men meeting after Jesus' death and conspiring to say that he had risen from the dead. This means attacking the powers that be. The human heart is singularly susceptible to fickleness, to change, promises, bribery. Only one of them had to deny his story under these inducements. Or still more because of possible imprisonment, tortures, and death, they would have all been lost. Well, the truth of the matter is that nobody, it doesn't matter what religious background they are at the time, Christian, Jew, heretic, ever confessed freely, under pressure, under torture, anything, that this whole thing was a deception. Even when Christians broke under torture, they threw the incense into worship Caesar, which is not what they were doing, but they never said this whole thing was a deception. Any of them in the early years could have said that, and they didn't. No Christian ever believed that this was a conspiracy, in fact. They wouldn't have become Christians in the first place. The cost of being a Christian was extremely high. Most of these men were fairly simple, honest, and common citizens. They were not cunning, conniving liars. They preached the resurrected Christ. They lived the resurrected Christ and willingly died for their conspiracy. I simply refuse to believe this. Creef himself wrote, "The change in their lives, from fear to faith, despair to confidence, confusion to certitude, runaway cowardice to steadfast boldness under threat and persecution, not only proves their sincerity, but testifies to some powerful cause of it." Well, a deliberate lie can't cause that. Just imagine 12 poor, fearful, essentially peasants changing the entire Roman world with a myth that they all came up with. No, it doesn't make sense. People of every background join the faith. Intellectuals, people with money, people without. The entire prisoner's dilemma thing would have had to be violated. The very fact that they would, coming up with this, there was simply no motive for any of this. Why come up with this lie? If you're going to make something up, Christ would not be the person you make up. Lies are always told for some, as we all know, some advantage, but what did they gain from this? Hated, scorned, persecuted they were. Excommunicated, tortured, exiled, crucified, boiled alive, roasted, beheaded. That's what came of it. And they were well aware of it. Christ didn't hide that from them. If the resurrection was a lie, the Jews would have produced the corpse and nipped this in the bud right away. All they had to do was go to the tomb and get it. Despite the fact that the Romans were simply acting reluctantly as agents of the Jews in this particular case, Romans and Jews of the day were on the same side. Unarmed peasants couldn't overpower Roman soldiers or rolled away the great stone. But these people slept on duty. Not to mention, the disciples couldn't get away with proclaiming this. Proclaiming the resurrection in Jerusalem. The same time, the same place, full of eyewitnesses. This was right afterwards. If it had been a lie, how was that even conceivable? It just happened. Here's what William Lane Craig says, who wrote Knowing the Truth About the Resurrection. This is from chapter 6. The Gospels were written in such a temporal and geographical proximity to the events they record that it would have been almost impossible to fabricate events. In fact, the disciples were able to proclaim the resurrection in Jerusalem in the face of their enemies a few weeks after the crucifixion shows that what they proclaimed was true. They could never have proclaimed the resurrection and been believed under such circumstances had it not occurred. It just happened. If the resurrection was a concocted, conspired lie, it violates all known historical and psychological laws of lying or human nature. It's unscientific, it's unrepeatable, it's unprovable. It doesn't make sense, therefore it isn't true. Now, I don't know if you know this, but I didn't know this until a few weeks ago. The hallucination theory has grown in importance. The idea that people were so worked up by all of this, the disciples and a few followers, that they actually witnessed this, witnessed Christ. In other words, if you thought you saw a dead man walking and talking, you would think maybe you were hallucinating. The truth of the matter, of course, is that there were too many witnesses. Hallucinations are incoherent, private, and subjective. They're very much like dreams. Christ appeared to Mary Magdalene, to all the disciples minus Thomas, the disciples including Thomas, two disciples at Emmaus, fishermen on the shore, James, even, according to 1 Corinthians, 500 people at once. You can't get away with the hallucination theory. Then Paul actually says in Corinthians that most of those 500 are still with us, that they were still alive. So you can go and check with them. Given the power of his enemies, they certainly would have every reason to. But there's no record of it. It simply didn't exist. What it comes down to is that the wide variety of times and places Jesus appeared, along with the differing, you know, mentality of the witnesses, that's your biggest rebuttal. You have men and women, you have men of all types, hard-headed, sentimental, doesn't matter. All believing they saw Jesus, indoors and outdoors. No, it's not a hallucination. That's not how it works. The odds that each person would be in the perfect frame of mind to experience a hallucination, even individually, at that point is absurd. But there's much absurd in the modernist point of view. They have a lot on the line. Hallucinations don't transform lives. I know a thing or two about who I've never experienced them myself. My wife works with people who have them. But even beyond that, the literature indicates that people who have these, they disavow their experiences. It terrifies them. Hearing voices, seeing people. They know subjectively that it's not real. They have to deal with it. One of them knew what was coming on, so would go into another room, in my wife's case. And yet, there's no denial that the disciples were transformed to the point of dying for their faith. Oh, and the word faith, by the way, the Greek pistis, is supporting that which is true, that which is demonstrated. In English, the word has been mutilated beyond repair, I guess. There's no text of the day, and I have been through them all. That's a separate story. And that is a separate story. I think I've said it once on this show before. None of them ever recanted. And the Jews would have jumped on that immediately. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Because if they were hallucinations, the Jews would have just simply found Jesus' body and pointed it out. So it wouldn't have mattered beyond that. These were qualified witnesses. They were simple and honest people. Five 500 saw Christ together. This is more remarkable than 500 private hallucinations at different times and places of the same Jesus. 500 separate Elvis sightings may be dismissed. But if 500 simple fishermen in Maine saw, touched, and walked with him at once in the same town and have the same story, well, that would be a totally different matter. Hallucinations only last a few minutes, a few seconds. Rarely hours and days and months. Well, this one hung around for 40 days. Hallucinations happen once. They don't return many times to ordinary people. There's no justification for any of this so far. And remember, the disciples didn't expect it. They weren't worked up as the concept of mass hallucination. You put mass hallucination into Google, see what you get. It's mostly about trying to refute the Gospels. They didn't believe it at first. Peter didn't believe it. Thomas didn't believe it. The 11 didn't believe it. Hallucinations don't eat, but the resurrected Christ did, at least on two occasions. Probably a lot more than that weren't recorded. Figments of your imagination do not hold profound, extended conversations with you. I've known, just from a purely anecdotal point of view, if you know enough schizophrenics, it doesn't work that way. It simply doesn't work that way. But they couldn't have believed in the hallucination if Christ's body was still in the tomb. The Jews simply would have presented the body. Truth is, none of these theories can explain all of this. All of this data, all of this minimal data, except the Christian point of view. C.S. Lewis wrote this: any theory of hallucination breaks down on the fact, a hallucination I'm talking about, of Christ, you know, being resurrected and performing miracles and things like that. Any theory of hallucination breaks down on the fact, and if it is invention rather than fact, it is the oddest invention ever entered the mind of man, that on three separate occasions this hallucination was not immediately recognized as Jesus, both in Luke and in John. Even granting that God sent the holy hallucination to teach truths already widely believed without it, and far more easily taught by other methods, and certainly to be completely obscured by this, might we not at least hope he would get the face of the hallucination right? It's he who made all the faces, that he couldn't work up a recognizable likeness of the man who was. That's in, by the way, in his Miracles, one of the first apologetic books I've ever read in my life. I read that in 1990, somewhere. Chapter 16. I didn't know there was such a thing as apologetics back then. The book Miracles was one of the many factors that got me started. Wait a minute, I'm being lied to. Now, of course, the concept of the resurrection is rejected because it's just it's miraculous by definition. Therefore, it can't happen. David Hume said that anything is better than a miracle. Well, he's talking about the church. He's not making a broad, profound point. He's not talking about the miracles of the Muslims or of anyone else. No, he's talking about the foundation of the clergy in his area. Now, the theory of mythology, and this is a little softer. The apostles were deceivers, inventing a story for some reason. The style of the Gospels is so clearly different from the style of ancient myths. Anyone who's read them at any length can understand it. Psychological depth is at a maximum. In a myth, it's at a minimum. In a myth, any spectacular external event that might happen would be distracting to add much internal depth of character, as C.S. Lewis would say. I always found it interesting that Christ writing in the sand, I really wish I knew what he wrote there. That's a telltale description of truth. It's a strange detail that no one really has to say. It doesn't go anywhere. The only explanation is the writer saw it. If this is all myth, then you're talking about a tax collector, the Mark, a physician, Luke, and John, fisherman, all independently would have had to invent a whole new genre, a realistic fantasy writing 19 centuries before it became recognized as such. Again, that's also from C.S. Lewis. He writes that in Modern Theology and Biblical Criticism, which is actually a part of In Christian Reflections, and also in Fernseed and Elephants, that I read quite a bit over the last week. Now, if you read the forgery, the so-called Gospel of Peter, this is one of the reasons it was rejected as a forgery. It's about AD 125. The regime tries to promote it, but I'm going to quote William Lane Craig's here too. In this account, that is to say, of the Gospel of Peter, the tomb was not only surrounded by Roman guards, but also by all the Jewish Pharisees and elders, as well as a great multitude from all the surrounding countryside who have come to watch the resurrection. Suddenly, in the night, there rings out a loud voice in heaven. Two men descend from heaven to the tomb. The stone over the door rolls back by itself, and they go into it. Three men come out of the tomb, two of them holding up the third man. Heads of the two men reach up to the clouds. The head of the third man reaches beyond it. Then a cross comes out of the tomb, and a voice from heaven says, "Have you preached to them that sleep?" And the cross answers, "Yes." Okay, that's how myths are written. That's why the so-called Gospel of Peter is laughed at. that's how a mythical conception of it would read, or even far worse than that. Again, because this stuff just happened. But this is what I've been saying. This is the overdone, overbearing imagery that a myth maker would actually write, especially back then, and especially these men. The Gospels were set firmly in first century Palestine. There wasn't enough time for anything to develop. There's small details that are mentioned occasionally. They're not picturesque inventions, but they're true details. An eyewitness might add. Now remember, this whole theory came from the assumption that the Gospels weren't written until the second century. In other words, several generations had passed, so a myth can be created. Well, that's not the case. Because eyewitnesses would be around to discredit the new mythic versions. But dates for the writing of the Gospels have been pushed back by every empirical manuscript discovery. No knowledgeable scholar today holds what like people like Boltzmann said was necessary to hold in order to believe the myth theory. That there's no reason to believe that there was a first century Christianity. It doesn't take much argumentation to realize that none of this is mythic, both in a stylistic sense and in the sense of telling a story for some benefit. There wasn't these several generations to build up a commonly believed conception. Not even one. You have others like, you know, Lao Tzu in China, Buddha. You have several where many generations passed before the myth was able to surface and be believed. Here's what Julius Müller wrote in 1844. One cannot imagine how such a series of legends could arise in a historical age, obtaining universal respect and supplant the historical recollection of the true character, Jesus himself, if eyewitnesses were still at hand who could be questioned respecting the truth of the recorded marvels. Hence, legendary fiction, as it likes not the clear present time, but prefers the mysterious gloom of gray antiquity, is wont to seek a remoteness of age along with that of space, and to remove its boldest and most rare and wonderful creations into a very remote and unknown land. That comes from him, the theory of myths and its application to the gospel history. But of course, you know, a lot of this stuff, the so-called German critical school assumed back then that the Gospels did not appear until much, much later than they really did. Müller, of course, who is a Christian, I'm not saying he was one of them, he challenged his 19th century contemporaries to produce a single example anywhere of a great myth or legend arising around a historical figure and being generally believed within 30 years after that figure's death. St. Augustine made a big deal about this in his Confessions. chapter 5, when he's talking about the Manichees. First of all, they wouldn't argue this stuff in public. They wanted to do it in private. And they claim, like the Muslims did, still do today, that the scriptures of the New Testament have been corrupted by some persons unknown. And Augustine says at this early date, the Manichaeans made no effort to produce uncorrupted copies. Neither have the Muslims, for that matter. William Lane Craig says the following. The Gospels are a miraculous story, and we have no other story handed down to us than that contained in the Gospels. Letters of Barnabas and Clement refer to Jesus' miracles and resurrection. Polycarp mentions the resurrection of Christ. Irenaeus relates that he had heard Polycarp tell of Jesus' miracles. Ignatius speaks of the resurrection. Quadratus reports that persons who were still living had been healed by Jesus. Justin Martyr mentions the miracles of Christ. No relic of a non-miraculous story exists. That the original story should be lost and replaced by another goes beyond any known example of corruption of even oral tradition. But to speak of the experience of a written transmission, these facts show that the story in the Gospels was in substance the same story that Christians had at the beginning. That means the resurrection of Jesus was always a part of the story. Well, there's been a few writers to note that the first people to see Christ resurrected were women. And women were not allowed to be witnesses in court. And it kind of makes laugh, you know, they're going to have their central tenet be discovered by people who had no standing, whose testimony was considered worthless at the time. Of course, it's what they saw, however socially and legally inconvenient it was. See, the New Testament makes a big deal of realizing, it's almost self-aware between myth and historical writing. 2 Peter, for example. It's not a myth, it says. So if it's not a myth, it's a deliberate lie, other than a myth. Gospels were written by the disciples, not later myth makers. And second, that the Gospels we have today are essentially the same as the Gospels, as the originals. Proof that the Gospels were written by the eyewitnesses. We have internal and external evidence. The internal, the style of writing of the Gospels is simple, what we would expect for, like, you know, more of a journalist than anybody else at the time. Gospels are full of proper names, dates, details, historical events, etc. The stories of Jesus' human weaknesses, disciples' faults. The disciples were, before the resurrection, awful people. That's how you know they're accurate. What's the first thing that the apostles did at the time of the crucifixion? They ran. The Gospels don't even try. If there's any kind of apparent discrepancy among Gospels, they don't try artificially to bridge that gap, as you may expect if it wasn't real. Forgers would attempt to do that. There's no anachronisms. The authors appear to have been first century Jews who were witnesses of the events. If it was a century later, 2 centuries later, they would have used a different language. Yes, it still would have been Greek, but it was a very different world then. No one doubts that Plato or Josephus' work are genuine, even though we don't have manuscripts for hundreds of years later. No, it's only when Christianity is concerned. That's when the the goalposts get extremely high. For everything else, yeah. Externally, as I've said before, there were many eyewitnesses who were still around. The church fathers are our guide in this respect, the early ones. The Epistle of Barnabas, Clement, Shepherd of Hermes, Theophilus, Hippolytus, Origen, Irenaeus, Polycarpus, Justin Martyr, Dionysius, Athanasius. Well, he's later. I shouldn't say him, but... And yet... You have a consistent idea. You could take the early church fathers, the first 100 years, and put the entire Bible together with all of their quotations. It's amazing. Of course, these writings were copied many times. No other ancient work is available in so many copies and languages, and yet they all agree in content. The abundance of manuscripts over a huge geographical distribution shows that the text has been transmitted with only very small discrepancies. The result of unintentional mistakes rather than actual doctrine. They couldn't have been corrupted without a great outcry on the part of all Orthodox people. No one could have corrupted these manuscripts. They were being read in liturgies. The text couldn't have been falsified before all external testimony, and the apostles were still alive and could repudiate such tampering. Well, I've gone on enough. Those who are still listening, I thank you. This kind of veered into a generalized apologetics, but it's all the same topic. Christ is indeed risen from the dead. We know it. We could prove it. The arguments of our opponents are awful, financed by the regime. Irritates me when I hear this Jew, Michael Shermer, talking about the New Testament being false. But the Paschal Mystery is, in fact, real. It's based in the Old Testament. And we have an obligation there. We're not talking about rising and dying gods like the pagans do, or, you know, Balder or Osiris or anyone like that. The truth of the matter is that Christ is indeed risen. I thank you all for listening, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.